We now move on to procedure. And again, I've got with me Sarah White, Attilio Stella, Will Eaves and Matt McAfee. First of all, we'll be looking at how cases are brought, examining the following issues. How do you bring your complaint? How do you get partisans caught? What forms of argument are there? Let's begin with how you bring your complaint and to whom. And let's begin with Will and with England and Normandy.
Well, in both England and Normandy, the action is begun by a writ. In England, the writ is sent to the sheriff of the county in which the dispute is located. And in Normandy, the early 13th century Tresenchon Coutumier mentions that writs are directed to the bailli of the bailliage in which the dispute is located. And likewise, the later Summa de Legibus of Normandy, written in the mid-13th century, states that the writ is to be directed to the sergeant-at-arms of the bailliage in which the dispute is located. And while this is going on, once the writ has been received by the relevant person, a view of the land is arranged. Now, the Norman writ and the English writ are slightly different in form, however. The English writ is a set of instructions to the sheriff to get the procedure underway. The Norman writ, however, starts off with the word precipe. In other words, it's ordering someone to do something, and it then lays out the procedure which ought to be followed if this isn't done. And this is more like actions concerning right in England. Now, the effect is probably the same in England and Normandy, but this fact does suggest that the Norman writ, as opposed to the Norman procedure, isn't modelled on the writ that's used in England. In fact, it seems to be a little bit antiquated. The English writs, which start off with the order, the precipe, sometimes called executive writs, and these are generally taken to be a slightly older form of writ.
So in both England and Normandy, a writ seems quite possibly essential, certainly in England, essential to the starting of this procedure. What about elsewhere in northern and western France?
In the lay courts of northern and western France, the complaint is meant to be made orally. So the complainant should make the accusation in person and will typically deliver it to his or her lord, provided that the lord has the requisite jurisdictional rights over the land in question. And if the accusation is meant to be brought towards the royal court, then the individual is meant to take the accusation to a bailli, or a royal judicial or administrative official. The complainant here seems to be meant to say that so-and-so has disseised me wrongfully, and the complainant may add that this was done with force, or need not say that at all. What is really unclear about the oral procedure is whether there is a standard formula for how such complaints were to be made. Generally, the main requirements seem to have been that the complainant provide specific details as to the questions of when, where, how, and by whom the dispossession occurred. And important within the act of bringing a complaint, at least within the customs of Anjou and Maine, is that the complainant is supposed to offer pledges to the judge or to the lord, and with these pledges, commit himself to the case. And then it is the lord or the judge to whom the complaint was made who initiates the rest of the procedure.
Sarah, what about canon law?
We have a very similar system in canon law as well to what Matt just talked about. When starting a case, a litigant would initiate an action by a petition to the appropriate judge, and the initial petition might be oral or written. So there's the possibility of an oral petition supported by the earliest procedural treatises, which were written in the 12th century, but later treatises tended to favor procedure by libel, that is, with a written claim. The plaintiff would prepare his claim beforehand and ensure that it included the names of the parties and the judge, a statement of the claim, and a request for redress. The document was then presented to the judge, and the defendant was summoned after the plaintiff had sworn that he would prosecute the case until the end. After this, the plaintiff would be able to present his libel to the defendant in court when he appeared.
And Attilio, is the situation in North Italy similar to the one that Sarah suggests for canon law with the elements of shared legal inheritance?
North Italian courts see similar developments with a passage from largely oral complaints towards written libels, libelli, which became predominant over the course of the 12th century. This transition relates closely to the establishment of the city communes and their courts, whose procedures share many elements with what Sarah describes for ecclesiastical courts. To start a case, a plaintiff or his attorney has to present a complaint to either a competent judge or his officers. This complaint will be exhibited to the defendant once the trial has started. As in canon law, this complaint had to include the names of the judge and the parties, a description of the main issue of litigation, and a request for redress. In some civic courts, this request had to be described in the form of specific legal actions, such as the interdictum unde vi, or the so-called constitutio sequis in tantam in case of dispossession, the reivindicatio to claim ownership, and so on. Besides civic courts, much litigation was handled through seigneurial and rural courts, in which people from the countryside arguably relied more frequently. In these courts, cases were brought in the placita, public assemblies in which villagers were compelled to participate directly to the lord and his agents.
So we have the case being started off. Now the parties must be got into court by summons. Sarah, what form does this procedure take in ecclesiastical courts, in canon law?
So in the ecclesiastical courts, the process of summoning is called citation. And the court draws up a mandate of citation, that is, a written order of summons, and dispatches it to the rural dean or archdeacon of the place in which the defendant resides. The defendant is allowed 3 citations or 1 peremptory or final citation before they are deemed contumacious by the court. If the defendant can be found, he's meant to be cited in private, presumably to minimize any loss of reputation. If he cannot be found, he's cited in public, most likely at the church. One of the procedural treatises notes, however, that it is not permitted to cite someone at the theatre or at the pub. Once the summons have been made, the official who performed the summons sends a confirmation back to the court confirming that he cited the defendant.
And what about in France, Matt?
In general, summons in Northern and Western France seem to have been delivered by a court sergeant or some other officer of the court. The customs of Anjou and Maine mention specifically that the lord to whom a complaint is made should send out a sure messenger to summon the defendant. If there's a dispute over whether someone was duly summoned or not, then one often sees, or the expectation, I should say, is that the summoner will come to court and affirm that he did what he said to have done, i.e. summon the person duly. And this would presumably be done by oath.
And Will, is the situation similar in England and Normandy?
Yes, it's similar in England and Normandy. The parties are summoned. In England, this is probably through the sheriff's bailiff. And in Normandy, it's probably the sergeant-at-arms in the bailliage in which the dispute's to be heard.
And Attilio, is Italian, North Italian procedure more like England and France, or is it more like canon law?
There are some similarities between the civic courts of Northern Italy and the canon law procedure. In Italy, the judge summons the defendant by sending his messengers to his or her house. And if the defendant is not found, the summons can be proclaimed loudly from the road. If the case involves villagers, the civic judge would send his messengers to the defendant's house or alternatively to the local council, the vicinia, to inform the rectors of the village about the summons and possibly command them to send the defendant to court.
So that's summons, but how do you actually ensure that the parties answer the summons, actually appear in court? Let's start with Will and England.
Well, in England, novel decision actually differed from other possessory actions. So in other actions, the defendant, or sometimes known as the tenant, was usually simply summoned. In novel decision, the writ commands the sheriff to attach the defendant or his bailiff, that is, to make the defendant provide gage and reliable pledges. In other words, to provide people to stand surety for them and also to provide something in gage security for their attendance. And the claimant's also instructed to provide security for prosecuting the case. The treatise known as Bracton explains that the people standing surety, i.e. the pledges, should be sufficient to pay the amercement due to the Lord King if the claimant retracts or does not proceed. And I think the use of pledges is standard customary procedure in England and France, but I'm not sure about canon law.
Well, usually the plaintiff would give a monetary surety or provide a guarantor to ensure that they will attend the first court session. So according to Ricardus Anglicus, for example, quoting Justinian's code, the judge should not receive the libel unless the plaintiff gives surety that he will prosecute the lawsuit within 2 months, and that if he does not, he will return all the damages to the defendant at double the cost, although this can't exceed 36 gold pieces. When he's done this, the judge can then receive and inspect the libel, but he's not to present it to the defendant until the defendant himself first gives surety to the plaintiff that he will appear. The defendant is then allowed 20 days in which to decide whether he will cede the case or contest it. A contumacy, willful disobedience by non-appearance, was the most common reason for delays in the case material. A first absence might be overlooked, but continued absence would indicate intentional contempt for which the penalty was excommunication. Absences could also be excused if there was a good reason, for example, illness or a storm, strong river currents, a family funeral, or being called away on government business to a higher court, so long as these delays were unavoidable and unforeseen.
And Attilio, what about the Italian situation?
Well, in North Italy, penalties, outlawry, and threats of confiscation were the main means through which judges tried to ensure the party's appearance in the prejudicial stages. In some cities, gages could be taken even forcibly from defendants to prevent default, even though gages entered ordinary procedure only after the defendant had appeared, that is to say, in the so-called judicial stages. Well, very briefly, considering case material, the most effective means to guarantee appearance seems to have been the threat of confiscation and ultimately loss of the disputed good.
So what are the consequences of unexcused non-appearance? Let's start with the plaintiff, who, of course, has every incentive to turn up because he, and it's usually he, is the person bringing the case. Let's start off with Will and England.
Well, in England, if the plaintiff isn't present on the day of the hearing, they simply lose the case and the defendant remains in season. And likewise in Normandy, if the plaintiff isn't present on the day of the recognition, they lose the case and the defendant is re-seized of the land which had been taken into the hand of the ruler.
And Matt, is the situation similar in France?
Probably is the easy answer. It was probably the case in Western France that the plaintiff's non-appearance would result in his loss of the case. But it's also worth stressing that evidence for the non-appearance by plaintiffs is very scant.
Presumably because they wanted to pursue their cases. Sarah, what's the situation with canon law?
In canon law, it's slightly more complicated. The plaintiff cannot be compelled to sue before the joinder of issue, that is, before the parties agree to proceed with the case. But nevertheless, if he delays, he's subject to a penalty, as I said, if he doesn't appear within 2 months. If the plaintiff is absent after issue is joined, he's called 3 times at the request of the defendant. If he refuses to come, if the plaintiff refuses to come after starting a case, he's then granted a year in which to pursue his claim, after which point the judge will hear the defendant and pronounce a sentence. If the plaintiff does come within that year, he can still pursue the case, but only if he pays the defendant's expenses for the delay first. If he pays the expenses and then abandons the lawsuit, he loses the entire case.
And Attilio, are we again in North Italy in a situation with procedural similarities to canon law?
Yeah, you may say so. The situation was very similar to what Sarah describes for canon law once again. Plaintiffs, just like defendants, were generally allowed to up to 3 delays. That is to say, they were allowed to ignore the summons for 3 times. The time set for such delays, however, tended to differ from city to city. Of course, failure to appear would ultimately entail loss of the case and gages, as well as payment of judicial costs and possible penalties. It's worth noting, however, that non-appearance of plaintiffs was much less frequent than non-appearance of defendants, concerning which rules were much more precise and detailed in the municipal statutes, for instance.
So what then about the person against whom the complaint is made? And we'll start again with Will.
Well, certainly in England, an assize of nobis aesin can proceed in the absence of the accused party. Now, there's generally a dislike for a case to go ahead without all of the parties present. And normally, in possessory actions in England, the absent party would be resummoned. And only if they didn't appear following this resummons would the case proceed in their absence. But with nova decesa, the case goes straight ahead. If they're absent, there's no resummons. The procedure in Normandy is similar to the English procedure, although it does allow for a slightly more delay, as one default and one S1, so one lawful excuse, are allowed before the assize proceeds, whether the dependent is there or not. And in this respect, it's similar to the other possessory actions that we find in England, with the exception of nova decesa.
And Matt, what's the situation in northern and western France?
In general terms, in northern and western France, the defendant is allowed a number of defaults and S1s, or excuses as Will explained, before judgment will proceed against him. If the defendant's default concerns a judicial hearing, as opposed to defaulting from an inspection day or recognition, then the complainant seems to get saisin of the contested property after the default is proved, i.e. the individuals responsible for summoning a defendant to a judicial hearing must swear that they had done so properly. And after that, the plaintiff gets possession. It's not clear, however, whether these general rules apply in cases of nova decesa. Beaumanoir, for instance, mentions that some cases of nova decesa require swift justice, and in these cases, the jurisdiction holder should take direct control of the contested property until an award is made to one party or the other. In these cases, there seems to be less scope for delay, but this also implies that cases of nova decesa that did not require swift justice may be subject to greater delay, and the distinction here seems to be whether, at what stage of the case the jurisdiction holder takes control or takes property into his own hand. At any rate, the defendant's default of the judicial hearing results in his loss of case, and he will be fined for the default in addition to any of the fines and penalties arising from the act of dispossession itself.
Sarah, what about the canon law situation?
Well, in canon law, if the defendant has been lawfully summoned in a possessory case, as was mentioned before, with a three summons and the delays that he was allowed, if all of this has happened and he does not appear, then the plaintiff is put in possession of the thing in question, not as a possessor, but by reason of res servanda, that is, for the sake of preserving that thing. But the defendant is then essentially made the petitioner and has 1 year within which to appeal and swear that he will undertake the lawsuit. After a year, however, the plaintiff is considered the possessor as if he had had this awarded to him by a judicial appointment, and the defendant can only sue concerning proprietary rights. But if the defendant can show that he had good reason for his absence, then he is granted relief from the default judgment either in part or in full.
Attilio, what about North Italy?
As in canon law, in North Italy, a case did not start before both parties appeared in court. The defendant formally received the complaint and joint issue. Defaulting defendants, as I mentioned earlier, underwent penalties and confiscation. For instance, in Milan, defendants failing to appear at prejudicial summons were declared in blasmo. Blasmo was a sort of soft and temporary outlawry. In this case, the plaintiff was temporarily assigned possession of the disputed property, which the defendant could redeem by payment of a fine within a fixed time and, of course, appearance in court. Similar, yet not so formalized, say, measures were taken in many other Italian cities.
That brings us nicely on to another issue, because we've been focusing largely on the parties, but you've just mentioned the assigning of the disputed possession. So what happens to disputed possessions during the process? Well, what's the situation in England?
Well, in England, it's said that the land is to be in peace, which I think means that the person who's got it remains in possession. And this is to stop self-help. In the early stages of the procedure in Normandy, I think it's the same. But by the mid-13th century, the land gets taken into the Duke's hand, and the Duke, of course, now being the King of France. And this prevents the dispossessor from getting the benefit of the land during the period before the case is resolved.
Matt, is that similar in elsewhere in northern and western France?
It seems to be. In western France, the customs of Anjou and Maine, for example, are very explicit that the contested property is supposed to go to the lord to whom the complaint has been made, and this lord will hold on to the property until an award goes in favour of one party or the other. And we certainly have case material, both from local courts and from the royal court, the Parlement in Paris, which shows that the jurisdiction holder does take possession and control of the disputed property until a decision overseas is made. But I've also mentioned earlier Beaumanoir distinguishing between cases of novel decision requiring swift justice, in which situation the jurisdiction holder is to take immediate possession of the contested property, and implying that there were some cases of novel decision where the contested property would perhaps not remain in the hands or not go to the hands of the jurisdiction holder.
Sarah, how about canon law?
Well, as I mentioned, if the defendant doesn't appear for the case, then the possession will be given to the plaintiff to keep it safe, essentially, until the defendant appears. But otherwise, the possession stays with the person who currently has it until the case is concluded.
And Attilio, what about North Italy?
Well, in North Italian courts, as in canon law, the defendant who does not appear loses possession. But if he or she does appear, the judge is to decide based on the specific circumstances. If at the start of the lawsuit the defendant is in possession, in most cases he would maintain such possession until the matter is decided.
Good. So what have we found? I think the key elements is that there were distinct differences in ways of bringing complaints. In some of the customary law systems, including England, writs were used, the form of writ varying between areas. Elsewhere, procedure may have been entirely oral. In canon law and in North Italy, the standard forms of procedure employing a libel apply. Pledges or sureties were the usual way of seeking to assure attendance following summons in all areas. Next time, we'll look at the way in which cases were decided in court.